My subject is light, L-I-G-H-T, light. Light is amazing and wonderful. What are the first words of God recorded in the Bible? Genesis 1, verse 3 says, let there be light. So the title is, The Lights of the World, Lessons from the Sun, Moon, and Stars. The word light is in the Bible 253 times, so it is an important subject, muy importante. And physical light, but especially spiritual light. I love the subject of light, and I love analogies. And so this sermon, I hope you like analogies, okay, because this has a lot of analogies in it. The subjects of physical light and spiritual light are both complex. Scientifically, light is mysterious, having characteristics of energy and matter. And so sometimes when they're analyzing light, they analyze it from the physical standpoint, because light is composed of photons. And I never knew that until I was in college. And so it is a mysterious thing. Some of you might remember that the speed of light is 186,000 miles per second. And so when you think of stars being light years away, that means they're a long ways away. And the distance from the Earth to the Moon is 238,000 miles plus, but to the Sun, 93 million miles. So to the Moon, I'm just showing you that the Sun is way, way far away, 93 million miles, whereas the Moon is only about a quarter of a million miles away. Now, one of the amazing things that is remarkable about God's creation is that when you look up in the sky, the Sun and the Moon look exactly the same size. And there's scientific benefits for that, because when you have a solar eclipse and then you have a lunar eclipse, they learn quite a bit. They are able to see things around the edges that they couldn't see otherwise because of the brightness and things like that. So I've read about that. I don't remember much about it, but there are scientific benefits for that, plus the fact that it's fascinating to us human beings to see eclipses. So God made the Moon just the right size so that even though it's much, much closer, it looks like it's the same size as the Sun. You know, in John 8, verse 12, and also in John 9, verse 5, Jesus says, I am the light of the world. But then in Matthew 5, he said, you are the light of the world. So is that a contradiction? No, the answer is in John 9 and verse 5. He says, as long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world. So he was the light of the world as long as he was on earth, but like when he went back to heaven, he was delegating that responsibility to the church. It's like while I'm gone, it's going to be up to you to be the lights to the world. So that's an awesome responsibility in taking Jesus' place in that sense. Now, the Bible does use a lot of symbolism to teach lessons like analogies and metaphors and similes. I'm going to turn to Psalm 19, which is a very popular psalm and quite inspiring. Psalm 19, beginning in verse 1, it says, the heavens declare the glory of God, and the firmament shows his handiwork. Day unto day utter speech, and night unto night reveals knowledge. There is no speech nor language where their voice is not heard. Their line has gone out through the earth, and their words to the end of the world. Well, of course, we learn a lot all the time from God's creation. It's so disgusting to me that so many people who are praising animals and plants and fish and birds and all that speak of these things as evolving. Every single creature is perfect. You know, every bird works perfectly. Every frog works perfectly. Every giraffe works perfectly. But every creature is very, very complex. It is so stupid and outrageous that people don't want to give God the credit. And instead, they want to worship the creation. And of course, the the Bible over and over again forbids the worship of anything but the Creator. But people tend to worship the creation. It is very impressive. And so people want to worship the sun, the moon, the stars, animals, birds. They worship all kinds of things except the Creator, which is absolutely inexcusable. Now in verse 8 of this same chapter, it says the law of the eternal is perfect, converting the soul. The testimony of the Lord is sure, making wise the simple. The statutes of the Lord are right, rejoicing the heart. The commandment of the Lord is true, enlightening the eyes. So we kind of see this analogy in the Bible that is talking about, at the beginning, the physical lights in the heavens, but then it starts talking about the spiritual light. So the physical lights do illustrate in some ways the spiritual light. In fact, Malachi 4 and verse 2, and I'm going to turn there. This is a surprising verse, and I'll show you what I mean. Malachi 4 and verse 2 says, "But to you who hear my name, the sun, the S-U-N of righteousness, shall arise with healing in his wings, and you shall go out and grow fat like stall-fed calves." Now, of course, God forbids the worship of the sun. But here is a verse that clearly describes Jesus Christ as the S-U-N, not just the S-O-N, but the S-U-N, the Son of Righteousness. And the sun is a wonderful illustration or metaphor for God and Jesus Christ, because of the fact that it gives life, it gives warmth, it gives, you know, many benefits. We depend on the sun, of course. The earth is just the right distance from the sun to give just the right amount of heat. It would be too hot if we got closer. It would be too cold if we were farther away. The rotation of the earth means that one side doesn't get too hot because we're constantly rotating, so no one side gets too hot or too cold. And so God designed everything perfectly. And so this refers to illustrating Jesus Christ as the S-U-N. And the fact that it speaks of him arising, it is like when Jesus Christ returns to earth, it's going to be like the sunrise. Now, before there's a physical sunrise, we see pre-dawn light. You know, for a couple hours before the sun actually peeps over the horizon, it gets brighter and brighter. Well, that's the age in which we live. It is a world that is becoming darker and darker because we're reverting back away from the Bible and away from God and more into stupidity and paganism and so forth. And so there's less and less interest in the Bible. So it's, in one way, it's a darker and darker period. But on the other hand, I would say, especially with the calling and ministry of Herbert W. Armstrong, God began to restore knowledge of the Bible and the plan of God and God's holy days and all these things to the church. So ever since then, we've had more and more understanding of the Bible, and we're doing a more and more effective job of preaching the gospel. So it is important that we are fulfilling that role of being a light in a dark world. And there are some scriptures that refer to us as being a light in darkness. And so you've heard the saying that it's, rather than cursing the darkness, we need to make a light. In other words, a room can be completely dark, and even one light makes a difference. You know, you can walk into a room with one little candle, and it makes a huge difference. You begin to see things and see where things are and all that. So even though we're a small church, and when I say church, I don't mean just United Church of God. I mean the full body of Christ, including all the churches of God together, that we're a very, very small group, but we're fulfilling a very, very important role. The sun, of course, is actually a very small star compared to most stars, but the fact that it's the close one, it looks huge to us. Romans 1, of course, is where it tells us that we learn from God's creation. But at the same time, more and more people are becoming fools in worshiping the creation instead. So Romans 1, beginning in verse 18, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all the ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth in unrighteousness." And there's a lot of suppression of truth going on these days. "Because what may be known of God is manifest to them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even the eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Professing to be wise, they became fools and changed the glory of the incorruptible God into an image made like corruptible man and birds and four-footed animals and creeping things. And so God gave them up to uncleanness and the lust of their hearts to dishonor their bodies among themselves, who exchanged the truth of God for the lie." And perhaps the lie refers to the idea of evolution, you know, everything existing without a creator. "And worshiped and served the creature and the creation rather than the creator." Well, that really describes the problem very well. And so much of what is happening in the world today is not new. It's like reverting back to past dark ages. You know, in Deuteronomy 12 and verse 30, God said, "Take heed to yourselves that you do not ask of other nations, how do these nations serve their gods? We will do likewise." We're not to copy other people's religious practices and beliefs, but that is what is happening. Of course, the highlight of the year for many people is Christmas. And of course, that originated with the worship of the sun, because that coincides with the winter solstice, and people celebrate the fact that, oh, now the days, instead of getting shorter, the days are going to get longer, so it's like the rebirth of the sun, and so let's celebrate. And so that's why that time of year is chosen to celebrate Jesus Christ. And so they're using pagan traditions to celebrate their version of Christianity. So instead of the Saturnalian, Brumalia is called Christmas. And so it's really disgusting. Now, even people in our church often tend not to understand very well the difference between the first commandment and the second commandment. You know, the first commandment says, "You shall not have any other gods before me." The second commandment said, "You shall not make any graven image," and so forth. So what is the difference? Now, if you're worshiping the sun, that's breaking the first commandment. But if you're using pagan images to worship Jesus Christ, then that's primarily breaking the second commandment. So it's important to understand the difference. And I remind you, in case you don't already know, that there are two major religions that pretty well do away with the second commandment because they love images and pictures and symbols and statues and things like that. One is the Roman Catholic Church. The Roman Catholic Church has all kinds of images and statues and pictures and stuff like that. Well, what they've done is they've combined the first and second commandments to make it sound like you just don't worship a false god, but then they take the 10th commandment and divide it into two parts. Like, we've got two commandments against coveting. Well, what the Jews do for Judaism, and of course the Jews love images as well. They love all their ceremonies and images and objects and their worship and everything. What they do, they take the verse that is before the 10 commandments actually start and say, well, that's the first commandment. And so then they combine what we know to be the first and second commandment, and they call that the second commandment, which they say, okay, yeah, we should not worship a false god. So there's two major religions that basically just do away with the second commandment because they're not about to give up all their images and symbols and things that they use in their worship. So that's kind of a side point, but it's important to understand and that we don't make any mistakes ourselves in the way we look at things. Of course, the carryover from sun worship extends to Easter as well. People celebrate Easter with a sunrise service, you know. Here the sun coming over the horizon, which to them is picturing supposedly Jesus Christ, but it actually goes back to sun worship. And of course, the popularity of lights, it used to be more candles, but then of course, when many Christmas trees and homes are burnt down using candles, once we have electricity, now people use electric lights. But the reason the red is so popular is because red represents fire, and fire represents the sun. And the green, the popularity of green, is to represent sexual abilities to procreate, you know, to carry on with life, a symbol of life. And so those are two major elements of paganism. Now, lights are fine, and giving gifts are fine and all that, but we just must not do it in honor of any pagan holidays. But Satan tries to substitute counterfeits for everything. And I really I want to thank Jim for his sermonette. That was really an important subject and illustrated very well how we've got to stay focused on making sure we don't have the ultimate regret in our lives. We must endure to the end. Now let's now I'm going back to how we are to be the light to the world, the lights to the world. And so I'll go to the key scripture, Matthew 5, beginning in verse 14. Matthew 5, verse 14, Jesus said, well, before that, you are the salt of the earth. And so that has several lessons attached to that. For one thing, we're to be sprinkled around. We're not all supposed to go to some monastery and live together and hide out, but to be spread out and be lights wherever we are. Wherever you live, you know, you are to be a light in your area. But salt is a preservative, and salt gives flavor, and so there's a lot of meaning to the part about being the salt of the earth. But then in verse 14, you are the light of the world. A city that is set on a hill cannot be hidden, nor do they light a lamp and put it under a basket, but on a lampstand, and it gives light to all who are in the house. Let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father in heaven. Well, of course, we're not to be glorifying ourselves. It makes it clear that by letting people see our light, we are to glorify God because we're representing him. But it almost sounds like it's a contradiction to the next chapter. In chapter 6, Jesus said, beginning in verse 1, take heed that you do not do your charitable deeds before men to be seen by them. Otherwise, you have no reward from your Father in heaven. Therefore, when you do a charitable deed, do not sound a trumpet for you as the hypocrites do in the synagogues and in the streets, that they may be seen, that they may have glory from men. Assuredly, I say to you, they have their reward. But when you do a charitable deed, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing, that your charitable deed may be in secret, and your Father who sees in secret will himself reward you openly. So it sounds a little bit like a contradiction. So you've got to understand the balance here, that you don't need to do everything secretly and hide what you're doing, because your actions, your good actions, your loving actions, are one of the most important ministries that there is. You know, you've heard the saying, I'd rather see a sermon than hear a sermon. You know, when you see in a good example, that has a bigger impact often than somebody's message. So our example is extremely important. And so sometimes when I want to do something for somebody, it's a little bit of a struggle in my mind. Do I do this anonymously, or do I let them know that I'm doing this for them? Well, usually I let them know that I am doing it for them, because I want them to know that I care about that person, that I love that person, and I want to be your friend and your brother and so forth. And so, you know, we're not to do it with a wrong attitude, like look at me and look how good I am. So I want you to meditate on those two scriptures and ask God to help you to have the balance there between having a right humble attitude and yet at the same time not hiding your light. One of the greatest condemnations of so-called Christianity is somebody who's a hypocrite. In other words, if you say, well, I'm a Christian, and yet you do something that's obviously bad, I mean, it's like, oh, if that's Christianity, well, then I don't want any part of that. So once you let people know that you care about the Bible and you care about God, the people are going to tend to examine you pretty carefully. It's going to be a good impression if you're doing something good, but if you're doing anything at all bad or seems bad to them, well, then it's like that's going to tend to discredit the Bible and discredit God and all that. So it is a huge responsibility that we do set a good example at all times. You know, you've heard about somebody who has some kind of a Christian bumper sticker on his car, and yet he's involved in road rage and ready to start a fight and everything. It's like, well, so if that's a Christian, then I don't want to be a Christian. So our example at all times is very, very important. But the emphasis in Matthew 5 is being a doer. There are people who feel righteous just because they have a lot of knowledge, and especially knowledge of the Bible. You know, there are people who, like, if they can quote scriptures and refer to scriptures and tell you something about the Bible, they feel like, I am really righteous. But the thing is, you're actually in trouble with God if you have the knowledge and you're not fully living up to it. Your example and your actions are much more important than your overall knowledge. The purpose of knowledge is to use it, not to just feel superior about it and feel righteous about it. Look what a great person I am. It's been hard for me to understand how people, in my view, can be such hypocrites. There are people who they lie and cheat and break various laws and all that, but the fact that they're making a good income and they have a big house and a big car and all that, it's like, well, I must be blessed. God must really approve of me because I'm prospering so well. It has been a major problem throughout the history of humankind for people to think that if you're doing well physically, that God is blessing you and he's pleased with you. But if you're crippled or blind or poor or you're a leper or you're sick or you're a woman, God is displeased. I think in Luke 12, I believe, it's in the book of Luke where Jesus said, when that tower fell and killed, I think, 12 people, do you think those were worse sinners? He said, no. He said, except you repent, you will all likewise perish. And then he used another example. He said, do you think they were worse sinners because of what the bad thing that happened to them? He says, no. What I suspect, when we think about the famous parable of Good Samaritan, you think, why did the priest and the Levite walk right by this man that was injured in the ditch when they're supposed to be religious, caring people, and they just ignore this injured man? what I would assume is that they thought, well, since he's injured, God's punishing him. I mean, he wouldn't be injured. He wouldn't be in the ditch if God weren't punishing him, so he must be a bad person. So I'm such a good person, and I've got such an important mission to fulfill that I can't waste my time fooling with this bad person. And so that has been a common problem. And so Jesus, during his ministry, he shocked people by the fact that he touched lepers and he healed people and he cared and he reached out to people who were sick and injured and gave so many helpful benefits to people who were looked down on in society and were neglected so much. And so that is, and it's always been a problem, and it continues to be a problem. And that's one reason why, that's one type of excuse people make for all their dishonest and sinful actions. It's like, well, I know that I'm not perfect. I know I do a few bad things, but I give a lot of money to my church and I donate to charities and I'm a deacon in my church and I sing in the choir and I'm in church almost every Sunday and I've got a really good income, a good job, and so God must be really pleased with me. So they can excuse the bad things because it's like a scale. You know, we've all seen Lady Justice, blindfolded, and she's holding up a scale, and you determine the weight by which side of the scale goes down. Well, the way most people think of justice, they think, well, if there's more on the good side of the scale than on the bad side of the scale, well, then I'm okay. You know, I just don't want to tip it the other way. That is not God's way of justice. You cannot find anywhere in the Bible that as long as you have a lot of good deeds, that it's okay to have a few bad deeds. You're never excused by God for the bad things just because you do a lot of good things. So that is a major problem in the thinking of the people of the world. So you see here in Matthew 5, when he's talking about being the light of the world, he speaks of your good works. And being a doer. Remember in James 1, you must be a doer of the word, not just a hearer of the word or a speaker of the word, but a doer of the word. And remember in the love chapter in 1 Corinthians 13, it says, though I understand all mysteries and all knowledge, but have not love, I am nothing. Well, you combine that with the scriptures that show that the clearest definition of love for God is obeying his commandments. 1 John 5:3, I think it is, for this is the love of God, that we keep his commandments, and his commandments are not burdensome. So the number one definition of love is obeying God and doing good and treating people according to God's word and practicing the golden rule and loving your neighbor as yourself and trying to treat your neighbor as good as you treat yourself. So feelings are important, and God created us to have feelings, but don't be ruled by feelings. More important, God judges us by our actions. Many people even have good intentions and do bad things. You know, the old saying, the road to hell is paved with good intentions. Good intentions are not enough. You may have a good feeling about it, and that's the problem with a lot of people in our world today, is they think of themselves as do-gooders. You know, I'm going to do good for people by certain actions or passing certain laws or whatever, and they make matters worse. And because instead of giving people freedom, as God intended, it's like, well, big brother, big government's going to take over and do things for you. You know, we're so full of love and compassion and everything, we're going to just let the government do everything for you. And you don't have to be responsible. Works, of course, do include words. Our words are powerful. And there's a lot that the Bible has to say about our words. In fact, the word words, W-O-R-D-S, is in the Bible 568 times. That's a big number. So the old saying, sticks and stones may break my bones, but words will never hurt me. That's ridiculous. Some of the worst hurts are of what people have said to us or about us, and not just physical injuries. But the works must go with the words. We can't just talk the talk. We've got to walk the walk. We've got to practice what we preach. And I think I mentioned before, there's a saying, I'd rather see a sermon than hear a sermon. So actions speak louder than words. And we've got to live up to it all the time, 24 hours a day, every day of the week, every day of the month and the year in our lives. So in the Bible, what does light represent? Of course, it represents knowledge, but knowledge that is put into practice. True knowledge true light is knowledge plus application. True light is knowledge plus application. So, now Satan knows how important light is, and so of course he offers light, but it's false light, it's false knowledge. You know, right away in the Garden of Eden, the serpent said to Eve, you know, come on, eat this fruit. You're going to have more knowledge. You're going to have more understanding if you just eat this fruit. But that involved disobeying God. You know, in Jeremiah 4, it speaks of people who are wise to do evil, but to do good, they have no knowledge. And so the greatest source of knowledge is the Bible. The Bible is the foundation of right knowledge. And we must start there. That should be the foundation of everything. In Job 38 and verse 7, angels are referred to as stars. And maybe that's because God intended the angels to help bring spiritual light. And of course, the chief of the light bringers was the one that we call Lucifer. Now, in Isaiah 14, it speaks of this great archangel, and most Bibles translate it as Lucifer. It's from the Hebrew word Heliel, H-E-L-I-L, H-E-L-I-L. Which means morning star or day star or light bringer. And because the first translation of the Hebrew was into Latin, the Latin word for light is luz, L-U-Z, and that's just where we get the Spanish word for light, L-U-Z, luz. And so his major responsibility went to his head, and he rebelled against God, but he still wants to be a light bringer, but it's all the false kind of light. It's like New Age stuff and you Gnosticism, and you want to be enlightened, and you want to learn all the mysteries of Satan and all of that. Gnosticism and emphasizes the light, and the Catholics and the Masons and the New Age people emphasize the different levels of knowledge. And so that shows you how knowledge can be falsely praised and deified. Now, I talked about the sun a little bit. What about the moon? The sun is a star, meaning it's very, very hot. The moon is not a star and is not hot. It does not generate any heat. It's cold. It generates no heat. It generates no light of its own. Where does the moon get its light? It gets it from the sun. It is a reflection of the sunlight. Now, God in his great wisdom created just the right kind of surface. If the moon were like a mirror, it would reflect the light of the sun so brightly that it would be just like daytime. It would be just as bright as the sun. So the moon reflects only 20% of the light that comes to its surface from the sun, which gives it just the right amount of light that we love to see at night. So it is reflected light. Well, we as the disciples of Jesus Christ, the church, we have no light of our own. We cannot not be like New Age people who look down deep inside and, oh, I'm going to examine myself and search myself and see wonderful things. You know, light does not originate within us. We are to reflect the light that comes from God and Jesus Christ, just like the moon reflects the light that comes from the sun. So guess what? We are moonshine. We are like the light that comes from the moon. In Genesis 1, it says, God made the lesser light to rule the night and the greater light to rule the day. So it's like we are to rule the night. We are in the nighttime. After Christ comes back, it's going to be daytime. But we're still in the night. And so the world, God depends on us to give light like the moon gives light at night. So we are like in the pre-dawn light now, bringing light to this darkened world. And so it's going to be the end of the night when Christ comes and the beginning of the day. So Jesus Christ is depending on us to be the lights during the night. Now he said you're to be the light of the world. Now isn't that a big exaggeration? How can we be a light to the whole world when we're such a small church and it's such a big world? Well, like I said before, a little light does make a big difference. And we don't understand all of God's reasoning. I don't understand why the church is not continuing to grow in numbers very much, and why there's not more of us to be the lights. It's like if you really want us to have a big impact on the world, you know, why don't you call more people and bring more people to the church so there's more of us? You know, when Jesus Christ returns, I'm making a list. I've got about a million questions I want to ask him. I mean, the Bible tells us a lot, but there's so much the Bible doesn't tell us that I've got lots and lots of questions. But I don't need. God tells us as much as we really need to know at this time. Light triumphs over darkness. I mean, darkness cannot extinguish light. I'm missing a page, but that's okay. I know how to wrap it up. I don't know how that happened. I thought I was so careful but I think the last page of my notes is missing. But to just think about that the important role we have during this dark time, in the way the whole last 6,000 years has been dark. One of the amazing things is how God has allowed Satan to be the god of this age and the ruler of the world. And we partly understand that God wants to test us and also that we can build character in another way by resisting the influences of Satan and all that. And God also wants to keep us somewhat in the dark. I mean, unless he's called you into his church. I mean, Paul makes this clear in Romans 4, 5, and 6. He elaborates quite a bit on how most people are blinded. Because once God opens your eyes to understand the Bible, then he holds you accountable. Well, God really doesn't want to hold most people accountable right now. He wants to extend maximum mercy. So he's keeping most people in the dark. And so it's interesting that the Bible calls the truth of God a mystery. It also calls paganism a mystery. Well, the pagans want to have a mystery. They like to think, I know secrets that you don't know. My organization has all these secrets and all, and they love to keep things secret. The reason the truth of God and the plan of God is called a mystery is because until God calls you and opens up your mind with the Holy Spirit, you can't understand it. And so it's only a mystery until God calls you. And then it's no longer a mystery. It's like, wow, now I've got spiritual eyes. As Matthew 13, I think it is, where he says, blessed are your eyes, for you see. And blessed are your ears, for you hear. And so when God calls you, it's no longer a mystery. And you're able to understand the wonderful truth of the Bible. So we have this a major responsibility. Now, there's a, now we are compared with the moon now, but I haven't even said much about stars. And part of my notes is, let's see, okay, Daniel 12, beginning in verse 1. At that time, Michael shall stand up, the great prince who stands for watch over the sons of your people, and there shall be a time of trouble such as never was since a nation, even to that time. And at that time, your people shall be delivered, everyone who is found written in the book, and many of those who sleep in the dust of the earth shall awake, some to everlasting life, some to shame and everlasting contempt. Those who are wise shall shine like the brightness of the firmament, and those who turn many to righteousness like the stars forever and ever. So you see, to carry on with my analogies, we are like the moon now while we're human. But once we are resurrected and we're glorified, we then are compared with stars. We are not just reflecting light, we will actually be sources of light. Not as much as Jesus Christ and God the Father. But we will have the inherent in our nature to be righteous and to have perfect understanding and to be able to teach others and to rule others in a righteous way. So it's a wonderful thing. And especially now that with this latest telescope that they're learning all kinds of things about the universe that they didn't understand before. The more they peer farther and farther into space, the more inexcusable people are for not believing in a creator God. It is so awesome. And so what an honor that the Bible is describing us as being like the stars of heaven once we are in the kingdom, once we awake in the resurrection to everlasting life. Then we will be like stars instead of just the moon. Now, you've got to stay close to God, and you've got to, in the meantime, and keep facing Jesus Christ. Remember, the moon is not all bright. It's not all light. It's only half lit. It's only the side that is facing the sun that is lit. The other side is dark. So that's a good lesson for us. As long as we're facing the sun, the S-U-N and the S-O-N, And letting that light come to us to be reflected, we are the light of the world. But if we turn away, then we will no longer reflect what comes from God and Jesus Christ. So we have a fantastic future ahead of us. And as Jim was reminding us, we must not have the ultimate regret. So I just want to, wrap it up by summarizing and saying that the moon, the surface of the moon is actually ugly. You know, the more we were able to examine it through telescopes and then actually landing on the moon, we see it's just all gray, just various shades of gray. There's no greenery, there's no beauty, there's just pockmarked with all kinds of scars from meteors and meteorites and all that. And so, brethren, the Bible makes it clear that human nature is not good. The natural nature that we have is not good. It is a downward pull, it is an evil thing, and Satan makes it worse by adding his influences to it. So what I'm saying is, spiritually speaking, of ourselves, we are not pretty. We are not beautiful. But think, when we are fulfilling our purpose in reflecting the light of God, we're like looking up at a full moon on a clear night and seeing the beautiful light that comes from that moon.